jacket and pants before pulling out a cell phone from a back pocket. Riley snatched it from him. "Is it locked?" Uncertainly, the man said, "No, who the hell are you?" Riley dodged the question, nodded, and bolted away from him. There was no time to waste. Every second counted. He scanned the forecourt and settled on a small burgundy station wagon that was just pulling out of its parking spot, and without so much as a split second's hesitation, he beelined for it and placed himself right in its path, intercepting it with his arms spread wide and waving to the driver to stop. The car squealed to a halt, coming to rest less than a foot from Riley. He didn't pause. He spun around the car and flung the driver's door open, then reached in and pulled the vehicle's sole confused occupant, a 70s stalwart in round sunglasses and a faded Steely Dan concert t-shirt, out of the car. "FBI, sir, I'm going to need your car," he told him as he threw himself behind the wheel. Without waiting for an answer, Riley pulled the creaking door shut, threw the car into drive, and charged off, only to slam on his brakes as a figure stepped in front of the car, blocking his way. The father. Standing there, staring down Riley with an unsettling cocktail of anger and confusion. Within seconds, he had pulled the passenger's door open and slid in next to Riley. Riley studied him for a beat. "You said FBI?" the man said. "Yes," Riley replied. The man took a breath, then said, "Drive." Riley nodded, turned to face the open road, and did just that. When Christoph saw the parked truck with the little girl sitting on the passenger side, he figured there was a chance the keys were in it. He spotted her after he'd splashed some gas on that fat guy at the pumps, tossed a match his way. Poof! Guy went up like a marshmallow you'd held over the campfire too long. While everyone was running over to see the show, he scanned the lot. He figured a guy on fire would prompt some people to bail from their vehicles without taking the time to grab their keys. That was when he saw the Ford, with the kid inside. Christoph sprinted toward it, clutching the brushed aluminum cylinder still in his hand. He'd had to let go of it long enough to whack that FBI agent in the head with the toilet tank cover, but he had it back in his hand now. Nearly a foot long, about 2 inches in diameter, it looked like a common thermos, but there was no coffee or tea in it. No, what was inside it was definitely not something you'd want to drink. Not first thing in the morning. Not ever. But Riley sure wanted it, and Christoph definitely wanted to hang on to it. Its contents were worth a great deal to him, worth killing for. Stealing a truck with a kid inside it, that'd be the least of his crimes by the time this was over. When he reached the truck, he grabbed the door handle so hard he nearly ripped off a nail when he discovered it was locked. But the window was down, so all Christoph had to do was reach in and pull the lock up. The kid shouted, "Hey, this isn't your truck!" Well, no kidding. He jumped in behind the wheel, hoping the key would be in the ignition. Hallelujah, praise the Lord, there it was. He half chuckled to himself. The very notion of thanking God when he had with him the means to destroy so much of what the Lord had created. He stomped 1 foot down hard on the brake, turned the key, got the engine going. He tucked the aluminum cylinder on the seat between his thigh and the center console. The kid wouldn't stop yammering. "Stop it," she shouted. "This is my dad's truck. Get out." Threw it into drive and hit the gas. Christoph glanced in the mirror, saw the crowd of people gathered around that hapless traveler. It was hard to feel bad for the man. In many ways, he was lucky. He got to go first. He was spared the misery that would befall everyone later. "Stop," the girl screamed. He glanced over at her. Maybe 9, 10 years old. Sweet-looking kid, really. Reminded him of his niece. Best not to think of her or any other members of his family. This wasn't the time to get sentimental. The girl suddenly leaned over, tried to grab at the key in the steering wheel, turn it back. Christoph brought down his hand, fast, hitting the girl at the wrist. She yelped, withdrew her hand, pushed herself tight up against the passenger's door. She was starting to whimper. "Shut up," he yelled at her. "Shut up or I'll throw you out." Which was exactly what he wanted to do, but wanting it and being able to do it were two different things. He couldn't reach all the way across and open the door and shove her out, not at nearly 80 miles per hour, which he was now traveling, and his foot easing down even harder on the accelerator. If he wanted to ditch the kid, he'd have to pull over to the shoulder, run around to the other side, and drag her out. Not a bad idea, actually, but he'd lose time. There wasn't much time before he was to make the rendezvous. But if there was no one on his tail... He glanced into the rearview mirror again. He'd already passed several cars since leaving the service station. No one else out here on the interstate was driving any faster than he was, but there was a car coming up from behind, growing larger in the mirror. A burgundy car, a station wagon it looked like, judging from the roof racks, but a small car. Maybe he hadn't hit Riley hard enough on that goddamn head of his. Maybe the son of a bitch had commandeered a car and was coming after him. Maybe having the kid wasn't a liability after all. The kid was leverage. What was Riley going to do? Run him off the road? Shoot out his tires? Run the risk of killing somebody's little girl? Then again, you could never predict what Riley would do. He was the kind of guy who saw the bigger picture, who might figure one dead girl was better than millions. Kristoff reached down, felt the cylinder by his thigh, felt its power. He turned to the girl who was still whimpering. Hey, come on, stop that. But you can't try to take out the key while we're moving. You could get us both killed. The girl sniffed, wiped the tears from her cheeks. Her eyes were wide with fear. So, kid, he said, what's your name?
Kelly, she whispered.
Kelly, nice name. Better do up your seatbelt, Kelly. Gonna be a wild ride. Riley had the pedal pressed down as far as it would go, but it still wasn't enough. The car, a Chevy Vega Camback station wagon from the 70s with wood-grain sides and a burgundy vinyl interior that had to be a health hazard in itself, was struggling to get above 60. Still, he thought, it could have been worse. He could have commandeered an AMC Gremlin, or a Pacer, or pretty much anything with an AMC badge on it, for that matter. Up ahead, the F-150 was receding alarmingly, a fact that wasn't lost on the Ford's owner, who was now sitting ramrod straight next to Riley, his eyes lasered on the vehicle his daughter was in. He's getting away, the man blurted. Why didn't you just hijack a scooter? Would have been faster. Riley frowned and squeezed the pedal harder, hoping to coax an extra mile per hour or two from the Chevy's asthmatic engine. It was no use. The Vega's speedometer probably hadn't swung past the half-century mark in decades, if ever. The faint smell of pot and patchouli that impregnated its interior only served to confirm this. Fuel, Riley asked, how much have you got in your tank? The man's face creased as he thought for a quick moment, then said, it's low, less than a quarter full. I was going to fill up after we ate. Riley asked, so what are we talking about distance-wise? How far can he get? The man thought again for a beat, then said, 70, 80 miles maybe? Riley glanced at the Vega's fuel gauge. It was almost half full. He processed this. Given the speed the F-150 was traveling at, that suggested an hour's driving time. And with the F-150 pulling away at a rate of 10 or 15 miles per hour or more, it would soon be out of sight, despite the flat terrain and the more or less straight road they were hurtling, well, gliding down. He had to find a way to bridge that gap. Quickly. Who is this guy? The man asked, what the hell's going on? Riley glanced across at him. The man was alarmed enough. He's a person of interest. We need to stop him. The man stared at him, his eyes wide with disbelief. Seriously? He raged. That's it? You're going to stonewall me with some kind of it's classified bullshit? That guy's got my daughter. He's got Kelly. Riley's guts tightened. He could understand the man's anger. He'd only recently been through something similar himself with his now 5-year-old son, Alex. He looked at the man and could just feel the fear and worry that had to be coursing through him. The only thing you need to know right now is that I will do everything in my power to get your daughter back, Riley said. That's priority one. Everything else has to follow on from that. Okay? Even as the words left his lips, he was twisting inside, pained by the knowledge that he was partly lying. Of course, the man's daughter would be a priority, just not the priority. Of course, he'd do everything in his power to get her back safely, but ultimately, the man Riley only knew by his online avatar, Faustus, had the potential to unleash a lot of damage, lethal damage. He needed to be neutralized.
Riley hoped it would never come down to it, never reach a point where a binary decision had to be made, where it would have to be one or the other, but not both. Some decisions were too horrific to contemplate. At Quantico, during training, they referred to them as Coventry moments, after the widely accepted but false story that during World War II, Churchill had allowed the city to be sacrificed and not have it evacuated so as not to let the Germans know that his men had broken the Nazis' Enigma code and knew about the devastating raid to come. It was nonsense, of course. The codebreakers hadn't known that the target was Coventry. Still, the story had become widely accepted, and the myth endured. Riley hoped there wasn't a Coventry moment waiting for him. The man didn't seem convinced by Riley's words. "You bet your ass she's priority one. I'll see to that." Riley held the man's gaze and nodded. "What's your name?"
"Garber. Glenn Garber. You?"
"Sean Riley.
That your real name, or is that also classified?"
Riley shrugged.
"It's real."
"Where's the rest of your men?" Garber asked. "Don't you at least have a partner or something? You guys work in twos, right?"
Riley grimaced.
Under normal circumstances, Garber was right, but this case had been anything but normal right from the get-go.
"I've been undercover and I didn't have a phone," he told Garber.
"Then things happened real quick. I had to improvise. I was hoping to connect with my people from the service center."
"But you didn't?"
Riley shook his head. "We're on our own."
"Well, you've got a phone now," Garber told him. "Use it. Get help."
But Riley already had another idea.
"I will," he said, "but first, tell me this. Does your daughter have a cell phone on her?"
Garber's expression clouded, then morphed from confusion to concern.
"Yes, she does, but why?"
Riley handed him back his phone.
"Call her."
Kelly couldn't take her eyes off the man. When you're a kid, everyone tells you to be wary of strangers. She was old enough now to realize anyone could present a threat, but when she was younger, she imagined strangers as evil-looking people. Long, pointy noses, devil ears, thick eyebrows, and bad teeth. This man just looked like an ordinary person. He could have been someone her dad worked with, one of his crew that built and fixed houses. But there was something about the eyes. They were cold. Worse than cold, they were dead. When the man glanced over at her and she looked into those eyes, she thought about when her dad took her to the Central Park Zoo on one of their trips into the city. She and her dad did everything together since her mom had died. She remembered the reptile exhibit and how when they looked through the glass, you couldn't tell if they were really looking at you or not. Creepy eyes. She noticed something else about him, too. He kept touching that cylinder, the thing that looked like a narrow thermos that was tucked between his thigh and the center console. Kelly was thinking about that when the sound of her own cell phone made her jump. It was in her small purse, which was on the seat beside her.
"That you?" Christoph asked, his head snapping right.
"Yeah." She took out the phone, looked at it, saw that it was her dad. She couldn't believe it hadn't occurred to her to call him before now, but she was so scared she wasn't thinking straight.
"Well," Christoph said, "you better answer it."
She did.
"Dad, a man stole the truck. I'm in the truck."
Glenn said, "I know, sweetheart. I'm with a policeman. We're following you. Are you okay? Has he hurt you?"
Kelly glanced at the man. "He hit my arm when I tried to take out the key, but it doesn't hurt that much."
"Honey, everything's going to be okay. We just have to figure out how..." "Give me the phone," Christoph said to Kelly.
When she hesitated, his eyes narrowed and his voice dropped an octave.
"Now."
Kelly handed it over. Christoph put it to his ear and said, "You're the kid's dad?"
"No," said Riley. "It was. Now it's me."
Christoph smiled.
"That's you in that little wagon behind me, isn't it? The Vega? Those things didn't run when they were new 40 years ago. Unless it's got a rocket launcher on it, I think you're screwed." "Let the kid go, Faustus. Keep the truck, but let the kid out."
Christoph chuckled.
"I think when I hit you in the head, you suffered some kind of brain damage. You pull over, and I'll pull over at the same time. There'll be a half a mile between us. Let the kid out. I'll drop her dad off, then it'll just be you and me. We don't need a whole lot of collateral damage here."
That prompted a second chuckle from Christoph.
Seriously? The collateral damage I had in mind amounts to a lot more than one little girl.
He leaned harder on the accelerator.
You're getting smaller in my rear view. You're going to have to pedal harder.
The Ford edged up toward 85. The truck cleared a stand of trees, and parked there, tucked in behind them, was a state police car. Kelly whipped her head around to see the car as they sped past it, then said to the man, I think he had radar.
You're going to get a ticket,
with a hint of satisfaction, like he was really in trouble now.
Son of a bitch, Christoph said, tossing the phone into a tray in the console.
He glanced in his mirror. The police car was shooting out of its hiding spot and hitting the highway, back tires drifting.
Siren on, lights flashing.
In the Vega, Riley said, Son of a bitch.
What? Garber said. He's got the cops after him. Isn't that a good thing?
Riley said nothing.
Looks like we're going to have some fun, Christoph said.
The cruiser was one of those souped-up Crown Vics, an interceptor. Christoph knew he could outrun Riley's commandeered Vega, but the cruiser was another matter. It was gaining on him fast. He couldn't outrun it, and he couldn't outhandle it, but one thing this Ford had over the Crown Vic was bulk. Maybe Christoph could run it off the road, but he'd have to let it catch him first.
Kellig was twisted around in her seat, watching the cruiser close the distance. You better pull over, she told him. You're going to get a huge ticket, and he's going to put you in jail for stealing my dad's truck.
Shut up.
The cruiser was coming up in the passing lane, siren continuing to wail. When it was only a car length behind, the officer behind the wheel was pointing to the shoulder, ordering Christoph to pull over.
Christoph hit the brakes. Once. Hard. The interceptor was suddenly alongside.
Which was when Christoph cranked the wheel suddenly to the left, ramming the pickup truck's front fender into the cruiser. The interceptor swerved over to the left shoulder, the left wheels rolling over the rounded edge. At that point, the driver couldn't right it, couldn't regain control, and get the car back into the pavement. The cruiser barreled into the grassy median, spun around twice before coming to a halt in a spray of dirt and dust and grass.
Christoph was looking in the driver's door mirror, smiling. I think your dad's going to be pissed about his fender, he said, and glanced over at Kelly.
He didn't like what he saw. Kelly was holding the cylinder. While Christoph had been occupied with the cruiser, she'd reached over the console and grabbed it. Now she was clutching it in her right hand, holding it up by the open window.
Let me out, Kelly said, and give my dad back his truck.
Christ!
Half a mile back, Glenn Garber's heart imploded as he watched the police cruiser's high-speed tussle with his pickup truck. He watched helplessly, his fingers squeezing the armrest until all the blood had rushed out of them as the cars collided. Then he breathed out as the cruiser spun off to the side and disappeared in a cloud of dust in the median. He glanced left at Riley, who was also fixated on the drama up ahead.
You need to call your people and get them to back off. You can't put Kelly at risk with another face-off like that. This guy, what was it you called him, Faustus? He's not going to give up lightly, is he?
I didn't expect him to. Glenn pointed angrily at the phone.
Then call your people. They need to steer clear of him. We've got a phone link into him. We can speak to him. Negotiate. I don't know, just no more of this Fast and Furious bullshit. My kid's in that truck.
Riley peeled his eyes off the receding pickup truck long enough to take in Garber's scowling face, then stared ahead again and nodded.
I'll send out an alert. Make sure no one engages him, but we can't just let him ride off into the sunset.
Even if he does let your daughter go, we need to make both things happen. We need to get her back, but we also need to grab him.
Why? Garber shot back. Kelly's the only thing that matters here. Even if he gets away, you'll find him again. You guys always do.
It's not that simple.
It is for me. We get Kelly back, priority one, remember? Then you use your drones and your keyword surveillance and facial recognition software and all the other tricks you guys have these days, and you go in and grab him, after I have my daughter back.
Riley grimaced. He hated moments like this. He wanted to say something to get this man to understand the seriousness of the matter, the utterly unthinkable consequences that might well occur if his quarry were to get away. But he couldn't tell him everything. Not when it was that classified. Not when security protocols dictated who could know the truth and who couldn't. Garber seemed to read his hesitation as he pressed on. Who is this guy? And what kind of a name is Faustus? I mean, Christ, it sounds like something Stan Lee dreamed up.
I wish it was, Riley said.
So who is he?
Riley weighed his words carefully. He's a guy with a grudge, a really big grudge. And right now, he's got the means to get himself some serious payback.
Garber went quiet for a second, then said, A grudge? Against who?
Riley slid a glance across at him.
Everyone.
Up ahead, Christoph had to fight to yank his eyes off the canister in the girl's hands and make sure he kept the truck on the road. That damn girl. After everything he'd been through, after everything he'd done to get to where he was now, even if it was in the middle of nowhere, far from the nearest big city where he could unleash the demon he'd risked everything to get his hands on, she had it in her power to ruin it all. He couldn't let that happen.
Give me that canister, Kelly, he rasped. Give it back right now.
No, she fired back angrily.
What the hell kind of kid is this? He fumed inwardly.
A stab of admiration cut through the rage he felt. She was a tough kid, and he liked that. Better than some sniveling, pathetic crybaby, he thought. A kid with some gusto in her. Good for her. Still, it wouldn't distract him from doing whatever it took to get the canister back, even if that meant snapping her neck with his bare hands. He couldn't just reach out and grab it. She was holding it right by the open window. He couldn't risk her throwing it out of the car, which is what she was threatening to do. The canister was supposed to be strong, able to withstand a considerable impact. But flying out of a car at 80 miles per hour, hitting the pavement, maybe getting run over by a car behind them? No, that would not be good. There would come a time when he'd be happy for the contents of that canister to hit the atmosphere, but not just yet. Christoph wouldn't mind a little time to get away first. Didn't want to be downwind and all that. So he needed to persuade this kid, who was starting to get very annoying, to be very respectful of that canister.
Kelly, he said, mustering as much calmness into his tone as he could, you need to give it back to me. You want to know why?
She scowled at him, a fierce determination radiating out of her face. But some uncertainty broke through, and after a moment she said, Why?
Well, right now the reason I need you, the reason you're still alive, is because of that canister. You're kind of my safety net, my way of making sure the cops stay off my back and let me get to where I'm going. But if I don't have that canister you're holding in your hand, well, then I don't need to go there anymore, which means I don't need you anymore. She thought about it for a second. Which means you can let me go?
No, he replied in a measured, calm tone. It means I can kill you.
He kept his gaze on her, able to let it linger on her now that the road ahead was relatively straight and flat. Do you understand? If you want to stay alive, if you want to give me a reason to keep you alive, you need to give it back to me.
Kelly stared at him, confusion clouding her expression. Do you want to die, Kelly? He asked, his voice taking on a sharper edge.
Do you? Is that what you really want?
He saw her lower lip quiver as the horrible realization settled into the little girl's mind. But she didn't say anything.
Do you want to die, Kelly?
He asked again, putting more pressure on the accelerator as the interstate began a long, steady hill climb. The flutter of her lip quickened. Then she dropped her eyes and shook her head slowly from side to side.
No, she muttered. I don't want to die.
Then give it back to me, he said. Give it back to me and everything will be all right. She raised her head to meet his gaze. He nodded to her gently and reached out with his right hand open, tilting his head expectantly. He saw defeat and acceptance flush through her expression, felt the tension ease out of his shoulders and neck as she brought the canister back into the car and rested it on her lap.
Good girl, he said.
A sudden thud from behind shook the truck and shoved him off the back of his seat.
What the?
He glanced into his rearview mirror. His jaw dropped, then he flung his head around to look out the rear window in disbelief. It was the police cruiser again, ramming his truck from behind. Only this time, it wasn't carrying any cops. Riley was at the wheel with the kid's dad sitting next to him, and he was charging forward again.
Are you out of your mind? Garber asked when Riley rammed the back of his pickup with the police cruiser.
Because the truck sat high in relation to the car, Riley was hitting the bumper with the top of the cruiser's grill.
Need to get his attention, Riley said, keeping his eyes straight ahead, his jaw set firmly.
And get Kelly killed at the same time, Garber said. You run him off the road, that truck rolls, and what do you think's going to happen to her? She'll get tossed out the window.
Riley, eyes still forward, nodded. She's got her seatbelt on.
Taking the police car had struck Garber as a pretty good idea. There was no way the Vega was going to catch his truck. When the cruiser went spinning into the median and Riley hit the brakes and jumped out, at first Glenn thought the FBI agent was checking to see if the cop was okay. Glenn figured the cop could look after himself. It was Kelly that Riley should be focused on. But Garber quickly saw that Riley's intentions were more pragmatic than compassionate. Riley was flashing his FBI credentials as he was opening the car door. The cop was awake and reasonably coherent, but his vision was impaired by the blood draining from a gash at his forehead.
Need your vehicle, Riley barked.
The cop said, What?
Is the car operational? Riley said.
The engine was still running, but the way the car went off the road, the steering could be shot to hell. The cop wiped blood from his eyes to get a look at Riley's ID.
I'm not giving my car to some dumbass fed who...
Riley reached into the car and grabbed the man by the shirt and hauled him out of the vehicle, tossing him into the weeds. The cop was going for the weapon at his belt as he fell onto his back in the brush.
You do not want to shoot a federal officer, pal, Riley said, getting behind the wheel as Garber ran around to the other side. The keys are in the Vega.
Riley dropped the transmission lever down into drive and hit the gas. The car moved, grass and stones brushing the undercarriage as he steered it back onto the interstate, tires squealing as they gripped pavement. Once he had the car lined up, he put his foot to the floor and the car moved. Garber looked up for a handle to grab onto as the car accelerated.
He's up there, but this'll catch him, Riley said.
Who is this guy? Garber asked. What the hell do you want him for? What's he done? Hoping, maybe, that his daughter hadn't been kidnapped by a serial killer, but some notorious but nonviolent embezzler. That might have made him feel on a panic scale that went from 1 to 10, only 15 instead of 20. Even if Riley had believed the father deserved the truth, there was no way he would have given it to him. Telling someone his daughter was trapped in a car with a man who had the capability to wipe out thousands upon thousands of lives, a man who'd had access to a government germ warfare research project that Washington didn't even acknowledge existed, a man who believed the best way to get attention for his cause was to start sending messages to the government under the name Faustus, threatening a biological Armageddon? Well, telling Glenn Garber his daughter was caught up with someone like that was just going to make him a tad anxious, wasn't it? So Riley basically repeated what he told the man earlier. He's a security threat. To which Garber said, No shit. The pickup was looming larger in their windshield. Garber could just make out the top of his daughter's head through the back window. Both the truck and the cruiser were pushing a little harder as the highway continued its slow climb.
So once we catch up, then what? Garber asked.
Riley reached into his pocket for Garber's cell phone, put it to his ear, then glanced at the contractor.
We're still connected. I can hear background noise. Hey, Faustus, you there?
He kept the phone pressed to his ear, listened.
What? Garber asked.
They're talking about the canister.
What canister?
Riley shot him a look.
Shh!
The FBI agent listened a few more seconds. Shit, he muttered, and tossed the phone back to Garber. He put it to his ear, shouted his daughter's name as Riley nudged the car up past 100. The truck was right in front of them. And then Riley drove right into it, which was when Garber asked him if he was out of his mind. Without a doubt, Riley thought. Without a doubt. When the cop car rammed them from behind, Kelly screamed as her head was snapped back into the headrest. Before she had a chance to turn around and see what had hit them, they were hit a second time. The canister fell from her lap, hit the floor in front of her, and rolled around on the floor mat. Now she twisted around in her seat to see what exactly had happened. The cruiser had dropped back a car length, and there, in the passenger seat, was her dad.
"Dad!"
she screamed, even though there was no way he could hear her. But she was sure he saw her mouthing the word. Kelly waved. Her dad waved back.
"Give me that," Christoph shouted, pointing to the canister. "Right now."
He had an idea how he could get Riley to back off. He'd threaten Riley the way the kid had been threatening him, with the canister. He'd dangle it out his window and make like he was going to drop it. Riley wouldn't want that to happen.
"I can't reach it," Kelly said, straining to bend over, the shoulder strap restricting her mobility.
"Undo the damn belt."
"My dad says I'm never supposed to take off my seatbelt."
Christoph gave her a look that said, "Are you kidding me?" Kelly got the message and hit the button to retract the belt and slid off the end of the seat to reach down for the cylinder. And as she did this, she thought. She thought very, very quickly. Kelly was not like the other kids. Kelly was only 10, but she'd seen and been through some bad things in her short life, the kinds of things that girls her age shouldn't have to go through. The big one, of course, was losing her mother. No little girl should lose her mom, and no little girl should lose her mom the way Kelly lost hers. But that was just the beginning. Not long after that, someone took a shot at her house, blew out her bedroom window when she was in the room. But it got even worse. Before that very, very bad time in her life was over, a man threatened to end her life. And not just any man, but a man she believed to be a good man. And who got her out of that fix? Well, sure, her dad was there just in time, but it was Kelly herself who took action. It was Kelly who thought of a way to disable that man just long enough for the scales to tip in her favor. In a split second, too. Kelly wondered whether a similar opportunity existed now. Something that might give her an edge, buy her enough time for her dad and the policeman to help her out. That was when her eyes landed on the cup of hot coffee, sitting in the center console.
"Great plan," Garber shouted. "Ram the truck. Is that right out of the FBI playbook?"
Riley had to admit to a level of frustration. He had no backup, and he had no weapon. If there was any good news, he knew Faustus had no weapon either. He'd checked him for one just before the man got the jump on him. What he needed was a frickin' helicopter with lasers, but this wasn't James Bond. This was real life. What he needed now was some kind of break. For the truck to have a flat tire, for it to run out of gas, but based on what Garber told him, that was unlikely. A goddamn moose trying to run across the highway right about now would be a blessing. At least the cruiser was topped up. He needed to get Garber to make some calls, try to get a roadblock established farther up the interstate. Or maybe... What the hell? The pickup was swerving all over the road. Kelly said, "Catch!" She was perched on the front of her seat, leaning down into the footwell. She had her right hand on the canister and tossed it underhand and to the left, aiming it right toward Christoph's face.
"Jesus!" he shouted.
He took his left hand off the wheel to catch the cylinder before it flew out his window, batted it down into his lap. Then it started to roll toward his knees. He wanted to catch it before it dropped by his legs, where it would be rolling around his feet, interfering with his operation of the pedals. It was during this moment of distraction that Kelly pried the plastic lid off the coffee cup and wrapped her hand around it. Her dad was right, it would have stayed hot all the way to their destination. How did anyone drink this stuff? As she whipped it out of the cup holder, some coffee slipped over the edge and onto her fingers, scalding them. It hurt like hell, as her father would be inclined to say, but Kelly didn't have time to whine about it because she only had about a tenth of a second to throw this too-hot-to-drink coffee in this bad man's face, which is exactly what she did. The black liquid arced through the air, splashing across Christoph's right cheek and neck, and judging by the way he was throwing his right hand over his eye, that too. Christoph screamed. Not Jesus this time, just a cry of intense pain and anguish. Primal. He tried to maintain steering with his left hand and was still attempting to see the road with his left eye, but the truck was pitching all over the place, and the canister had hit the floor, rolling side to side in time with Christoph's erratic steering. Christoph took his right hand off his face long enough to make a wild, retaliatory swing in Kelly's direction, but she had pushed herself up against the door, out of reach, and was thinking about whether to hop over the seat and hide in the narrow space behind them, but she decided against that, figuring that if the truck came to a stop or even slowed, she needed to be by the door so she could hop out. Indeed, the truck was slowing. Christoph had taken his foot off the gas, and given that the truck was heading up a slight grade, it was going to lose speed even more quickly. He hadn't hit the brake yet, but he couldn't keep up his recent pace when he couldn't see where he was going. After another couple of futile swings at Kelly, the man put his hand back to his face, but then he realized the wounds hurt too much to touch. His right eye remained closed. He screamed, "You blinded me! You fried my eye, you little bitch!" Kelly was probably more scared right now than she'd ever been in her life, even more than when that man threatened her a few years ago. But she also felt pretty good. For half a second, she'd wondered whether she'd get in trouble for making a man lose one of his eyes, but then thought her dad would probably be okay with it. He could be pretty cool about things. She glanced back through the window, saw the police car still there, waved at her dad again as the truck lurched from left to right. Then she heard the familiar sound of gravel under the tires. She whirled around, saw that they were veering off the pavement onto the shoulder. Christoph had his foot on the brake. He hung his head low, moved it languidly back and forth, trying to deal with the pain. When the truck was nearly stopped, Kelly pulled on the door handle, let the door swing wide, and jumped. "Kelly!" Glenn Garber screamed when he saw his daughter leap from the passenger's door of the nearly stopped truck. He bolted from the police cruiser before Riley had thrown it into park. Kelly landed in the tall grasses just beyond the shoulder. Her knees buckled, forcing her into a roll, her body tumbling out of view. Glenn ran, "Kelly! Kelly!" Before he could get to her, her head popped up above the grass. An arm went into the air. "Here!" Behind him, Garber heard Riley shout at the top of his lungs, "Run!" It wasn't that Riley didn't care about Garber and his kid, but he had a more pressing matter to deal with, like the man he knew as Faustus, who had thrown open the driver's door of the pickup and was stumbling out, but not before reaching for something on the floor ahead of the seat. He emerged, standing there a couple of steps in front of the open door, clutching the cylinder, raising it above his head. Whoa. Riley didn't know what the hell had happened in that truck, but half of the man's face was red and blotchy and blistered, and some of the skin looked like it was ready to fall off. His right eye was shut. Riley told Garber and his daughter to run. "I'll do it," the man yelled. "I'll smash it right into the road. I'll crack this thing wide open. You want that?" Riley raised an unthreatening palm. "Come on," the FBI agent said. "You'll take yourself out, too. You'll never have the fun of seeing your handiwork." "Doesn't much matter now," he said. Behind them, other motorists on the highway slowed. A couple honked their horns. Riley ignored them, instead staying focused on Faustus. He couldn't stop himself from asking, "What the hell happened to your face?" "Hot coffee," Faustus said. "Maybe I'll sue." Riley noticed that the truck was moving ever so gradually. They'd all stopped on a very slight uphill grade, and the Ford was starting to roll back. Faustus had bailed out of it so quickly, he must not have put the shift solidly into park. By the time Faustus noticed, it was too late to react. The open driver's door caught him on the back and threw him down onto the highway like he'd been tackled. The bottom edge of the door hit the back of his head hard enough that he did a face plant on the pavement, arms outstretched. He wasn't moving, only his fingers twitching, releasing their grip on the cylinder, which started to roll along the asphalt toward Riley, bumping over small stones and irregularities in the surface. "Please don't have opened. Please don't have opened." Riley bolted forward, threw his body over the cylinder, trapped it below his torso, smothering it like it was a grenade. Even though it was not going to explode, it had the potential to do more damage than 1,000 grenades. The truck rolled past him to his right, the front wheels turning slightly, angling the truck's back end toward the ditch. As it rolled by, Riley saw Garber and his daughter a good 50 yards away, heading for a wooded area beyond the highway's edge. Garber glanced back, saw Riley on the ground, grabbed Kelly by the elbow to stop her. Riley could just barely hear him tell her, "Stay here," and then he came running.
"Are you hit?" Garber shouted.
"No."
"What about him?"
"I'm guessing dead. That door hit him hard, and then his head hit the pavement. He hasn't moved."
"Why are you lying on—"
"Have you got a bag in your truck, a plastic bag, a couple of them, anything airtight?"
A thought hit him. "Evidence bags in the cruiser."
Garber stopped, ran for the police car, grabbed the keys, and ran around back to pop the trunk. It took him about 15 seconds to find what he was looking for. Clear plastic, sealable bags, like oversized sandwich bags. He grabbed a handful and ran back to Riley as his truck slowly backed into the ditch, the engine still running. The agent, still keeping his body pressed to the pavement, reached up for a bag.
"Give it to me."
Garber had some sense of how serious the situation was.
"Should I start running again?" he asked.
Riley grimaced. "Probably not much point. We're either safe or we're not. You couldn't run fast enough to save yourself." He worked the bag under his torso, then in one swift motion got up on his knees, shoved the cylinder into it, and sealed the top. Garber realized he was holding his breath.
"You've got the end of the world in that bag, don't you?"
"Pretty much," Riley replied.
"Hand me another. I'm going to double bag it, maybe even triple."
"Did anything leak out?"
"If we're still standing a minute from now, I'd say no."
He reached out a hand to Garber and he took it. He helped the agent to his feet and they regarded each other for a moment. Garber kept glancing at his watch.
30 seconds.
"Give it a little longer," Riley said.
"If it happens, what exactly will happen?"
"You don't want to know.
The good news is, it'll be quick."
Garber kept his eye on his watch.
"That's a minute and a half now. I'd say we're going to live."
Riley smiled.
"Your kid threw hot coffee in his face?"
Garber nodded. The smile turned into a grin.
"Get her over here."
Garber waved Kelly in. She arrived nearly breathless several seconds later, shaken but relieved too. Riley rested his hands on her shoulders.
"You are something else."
Kelly smiled weakly.
"Really, you are," Sean Riley said. "You ever need anything, you just name it."
Kelly thought a moment. She said,
"I never did get my chicken nuggets."
John Lesquois versus T. Jefferson Parker. The genesis of this story goes all the way back to 2009, when John and Jeff discovered a shared love of fishing while contributing a short story to an anthology called Hook, Line, and Sinister. Then, in 2011, the two hung out together on a deep-water fly fishing trip to East Cape in Saravo Island in Baja California. Every day for a week, the anglers set out at dawn in pongas, Mexican fishing boats, seeking tuna, dorado, roosterfish, amberjack, pompano, or whatever else might be biting. Their guides were a fantastic and personable collection of skilled pilots and fishermen, mostly from one extended family who lived in the nearby village of Agua Amarga. When they were approached with the concept for Face Off, both immediately glommed onto the idea of John's Wyatt Hunt, the Hunt Club, Treasure Hunt, and the Hunter, and Jeff's Joe Trona, Silent Joe, teaming together. Both characters were close to the same age, athletic, and were more or less involved with law enforcement, so putting them together on a fishing trip to Baja was a no-brainer. As soon as the two characters showed up on the page together, the chemistry was clear and palpable. John and Jeff quickly discovered that if those two characters actually existed in real life, they would probably be buds. Friendship aside, though, this is a thriller anthology, so the story needed an adventure that would place the heroes in danger. Jeff had done quite a lot of research into Mexico's narcotraficantes. Headlines from around the world attest every day that there is a serious problem with drug trafficking in that part of the world. So what could be better, fiction-wise, than to have these gangsters threaten a tightly knit, extended family of hardworking fishermen. And what would poor fishermen possess that could possibly lure the local narcotraficantes out to their village so that they could steal it? These good people don't do drugs, they're not political, they fish and play baseball. But there is one other little-known and only partially explored commodity in Baja California that would draw the attention of gangsters. Gold. A hidden stash that could rejuvenate a little fishing town, providing money for a new electric generator to make ice and run refrigerators, to power streetlights and buy new motors for the pongas. But the narcotraficantes have also heard rumors of gold, where it's hidden, who's hiding it. They won't hesitate to torture and kill to get their hands on it. What's to stop them? Just two Americans, Wyatt Hunt and Joe Trona, down in Mexico on a fishing vacation.
Silent Hunt. Wyatt made it to his gate in the international terminal of LAX with an hour to spare before boarding would begin for his noon connecting flight to La Paz. He was traveling light, with one brand new light brown on dark brown carry-on duffel bag into which he'd stuffed nearly $2,000 worth of new fly fishing gear, his toilet kit, and two changes of clothes, long pants of good wicking material that with a zip converted into shorts, and two long sleeve shirts, the latter items newly purchased from REI, against what was forecast to be debilitating heat. 8 hours a day on the water, no shade, average temperature around 110. It was September, and his party of 10, all unknown to him, were going after dorado, roosterfish, various tuna, and the occasional marlin, sailfish, or shark. None of these fish would weigh less than 10 pounds, and some might go to 100 or more. Hunt, a lifelong fly fisherman in streams for trout in the half-pound range, was skeptical about the ability of his new gear to handle fighting fish of this size and caliber, but he was game to try. In any event, he was a gear freak, and the new stuff, 10-weight and 12-weight rods, reels holding over 100 yards of 60 and 80-pound test backing, barbed and artistically feathered hooks the length of his fingers, was undoubtedly cool. He'd gone out with a fishing pro in San Francisco's Baker Beach 4 times over the past month, trying to master the casting technique known as double hauling, essential if you wanted to reach surface targets in saltwater. He was still far from expert, but at least felt he wouldn't completely embarrass himself. With time to kill and slumping a bit after his 5 a.m. wake-up, he grabbed an open chair at the end of the bar, stuffed his duffel down under his feet, and ordered a large cup of coffee. When he'd finished about half of it, he turned to the guy next to him, a portly, pale, bald guy in a bright red and green Hawaiian shirt. "You mind watching my duffel a minute?" he asked. "I've got to hit the head." The older gentleman, already drinking something with an umbrella in it, looked down at Hunt's duffel and broke an easy smile. "We are urged not to leave our baggage with strangers, are we not?" "Constantly." Hunt had covered his half cup with a napkin and was already on his feet, now suddenly in a bit of a hurry. He lowered his voice. "I promise it's not a bomb. You can look if you want." "I'm going to trust you," the gentleman said. "Go already." On the way to the men's room, Hunt, not for the first time, found himself reflecting on the fact that in many ways, despite his own demise, Osama bin Laden had basically won the first round of the war on terror. Already that morning, Hunt not once but twice had to take off his shoes and belt, empty his pockets, and assume the position in the TSA's X-ray machine. A victim of his early morning fatigue in San Fran, if they hadn't just changed the rules again, he'd also have donated to the cause the Swiss Army knife he'd forgotten in his pocket, which would have been the third time that had happened. Even if he acknowledged the general reason for it, the whole thing pissed him off. As if the geezer next to him was going to steal his duffel bag. He didn't look like he could even lift the thing. As if anybody, for that matter, in the secured area for boarding was an actual threat to take anybody else's luggage. Caught up in his internal rave, Hunt ran with it. Let's see. First, your potential thief needs a valid boarding pass with photo ID, then he's half-stripped and x-rayed, and he's going along with this runaround because of the very off chance that some random person will leave their baggage unattended. Hunt loved that word. And that he would then have an opportunity to steal it. And then what? Leave the building with his loot? When had that happened? Had it ever happened? Could it ever happen? Who thought of these things? What was the average IQ of a TSA employee anyway, or of the goddamn director of the Department of Homeland Security for that matter? Room temp at best, Hunt was thinking as he exited the men's room. Just in time to see a guy about his own age and size in jeans, a work shirt, and a San Diego Padres baseball hat pulled down low over his eyes, strolling toward the security gates with Hunt's pretty damn distinctive duffel bag slung under his left shoulder. Jesus Christ. Hey, Hunt yelled after him. Hey, wait up there. The guy kept walking. Hunt broke into a trot. The other man was at least 60 feet away from Hunt and now almost to the exit. The thief moved with an easy grace, taking long strides, neither slowing down in the least nor speeding up, but moving, moving, moving. He would be at the exit within seconds. When he had to, Hunt, the athlete, could move too, and now he turned on the speed, closing the gap between them, calling out, "Stop that guy!" to no one in particular, but drawing the attention of every traveler in the terminal. He finally caught up just as the guy was arriving in front of the exit gate. Hunt came up behind him and with a lunge grabbed at the duffel, getting a hold on it. "Hey, hold up! What do you think you're doing?" Hunt pulled at the strap. The guy held on, whirled, and threw an elbow that Hunt barely ducked away from. But in that one fluid movement, Hunt realized he was dealing with a strong, lightning-fast, and trained fighter. Hunt himself had a black belt in karate, and this guy, even hampered by the heavy duffel, was coming on as at least his equal, in any case a force to be reckoned with. Now he had Hunt backing away, and like any experienced fighter, he kept coming, dropping the duffel and coming around with the right chop that Hunt knocked away with his forearm. It felt like he'd stopped a tire iron. Squaring up now, ready to press an attack of his own, Hunt got his first good look at the man's face, and it stopped him cold. Nearly half of it bore the scars of a serious burn injury, almost as though the skin had been melted away. It immediately took the fight out of Hunt, though his breath was still coming hard. "What the hell are you trying to do?" he rasped out. The other man spoke with an unnerving calm. "What am I trying to do? You just attacked me. I was defending myself." "You were walking out with my duffel." "That's not your duffel. It's mine. And I wasn't walking out anywhere. I was going to buy a newspaper." He pointed. "At this shop right here." Meanwhile, three TSA officers had broken through the ranks of onlookers, and one of them, Hillier by his name tag, advanced on them, arms spread out, asserting control. "All right, everybody, easy, easy now. What's going on here?" "This guy," Hunt said, "was making off with my duffel bag." "It's mine, sir," the scarred man replied, dead calm. With his own first look at the man's face, Hillier, too, took an extra beat, then came back to Hunt, who said, "That's my duffel. You can check it out. It's filled with fishing gear. I'm on my way down to Baja." "So am I," the scarred man said. He reached into his shirt pocket and held out a boarding pass. "With your permission, sir," he said to Hillier. Going to one knee, he pulled around the identification tag attached to the strap and held it out first to the TSA officer, then to Hunt. "Joe Trona," he said. "That's me." He stood and reached behind him and took out his wallet, which also revealed a badge. Hillier inspected the badge and seemed to read every word on it, twice looking from badge to man. "I'm a police officer, and I promise you I did not steal this man's duffel bag." Hillier unzipped the duffel for a quick look. Hunt saw the neatly arranged reels and spools of fishing line similar to his own. Hillier looked at Trona, then to Hunt. "When did you last see your own duffel bag, sir?" "I left it at the bar when I went to the bathroom. The man sitting next to me was watching it, but then when I came out, I saw..." He stopped because there was nothing more he could say. "I'm a horse's ass, Mr. Trona," he said. "I owe you an apology." Trona looked at Hunt, but said nothing. "Let's go see if your duffel's still at the bar," Hillier said to Hunt. "As our announcement says, many items of luggage look the same. If it's still there, let's not leave it unattended anymore. How's that sound?" Joe Trona stood in the shade outside the La Paz terminal, his back to the wall in the infernal Baja heat. His duct tape quiver of rod cases lay safely along the wall, along with his duffel and a cooler. The van would be there any minute. "The horse's ass. Hunt sounds better. Apology accepted." Hunt joined Trona in the shade and offered his hand. "Wyatt. Are you fishing out of Baja Joe's?" "First time. Always an adventure." Trona watched a gaggle of pretty Mexican flight attendants walk roll past them and into the terminal. One glanced at him, trying to be furtive, then let her gaze brush off of his face and into the sky, where she pretended to be interested in a descending passenger jet. Even with a hat on and the brim pulled low, Trona's scar-studded face was spectacularly there. By now, after living 30-odd years with that face, Trona actually forgot about it sometimes. Of course, the reminders were always quick to come, reflections, people from adults to children, even dogs. "You're the deputy from Orange County," said Hunt. Trona nodded and enjoyed the inevitable beat of silence. "It's been 10 years since all that. It's good to be out of view." "Don't I know," said Hunt. "Those murders you worked in San Francisco were big news down south. Took you all the way back to 78 in Jonestown. Man, history isn't so ancient." "No," said Trona. "Not when Richard III shows up under a parking lot. How's the PI work?" Hunt shrugged. "I read about the cartel trouble here in La Paz. Zeta's barging in on La Familia, is what I heard." "Long as they stay away from Baja Joe's," said Trona. "All I want is 6 days of peace, quiet, and fishing. Maybe some bourbon. Let's fish together tomorrow. I'll show you what I've learned. Twist my arm." The van and its 6 passengers bounced down the beaten 2-lane asphalt that led toward the bay. Trona looked out at the Cardong cactus and the elephant trees and the vultures circling precisely in the blue. He couldn't wait to get on the water. They slowed down for a Policia Preventiva officer standing by his truck, flares in an angled line behind him, belching pink smoke. He saw more vehicles up ahead. The cop talked to the driver, and the driver showed ID, and the cop looked at each fisherman, then waved them through. When they passed the other cars, Trona saw that one was a white Suburban, new and shiny, windows riddled with bullet holes and smeared with red. 2 bodies slumped within. 2 more lay on the road shoulder, one covered with blankets, one not. Another police officer hurried them past. "There is very little crime in this part of Baja," said the driver resolutely. "Very little. Occasional only." Trona wondered what the occasion was. He looked at Hunt, who had to be thinking the same thing.